Hello, and welcome to another episode of Reason Town. I'm here with Paul Bigger from Darklang, who just made a splash a week ago with his Elm to Reason conversion tool. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Jared. Lovely to be here.
Thank you. And before we get started, I'd like to thank our sponsor, TylerMcGinnis.com, that provides the bandwidth and hosting costs. Tyler's actually doing a Reason bootcamp as we're recording this, which you should definitely check out. And also his courses on JavaScript and various frameworks. So today we're going to talk about Reason. We'll talk about Elm. But first, Paul, could you tell us a little bit about your background?
Sure. So I'm currently the CTO of Dark, darklang.com, which is an attempt to remove all the accidental complexity from how we code, and make coding. At least coding of backends 100 times easier.
That's a tall order.
It is a tall order. We're building a language. We're building infrastructure. We're building an editor. It's really fun. It's really interesting. And then before that, I was the CEO and co-founder of Circle CI. Before that, I did a PhD in static analysis. And then I also have a podcast called To Be Continuous, which is all about continuous delivery.
Cool. So PhD in static analysis, what was your dissertation about?
It was about static analysis and optimization of PHP.
Okay.
That was a fun couple of years, the digging into the weird and wacky semantics of PHP, which I think nobody really knows.
Right. I imagine you've spent time looking at Hack as well, the Facebook's.
You know, I have not looked at Hack once.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
I think it came out after my thing. I looked at the Facebook's PHP spec when it came out.
Uh-huh.
I thought that was really good, and I looked a bunch at HHVM, which I think preceded Hack, but by 2010, but you know, when I finished my PhD, I was just done. I was, you know, you work on a thing for 4 or 5 years, and then like you just don't want to look at that thing anymore.
Right, I can imagine. So you just swore off PHP for the rest of your career.
Yes, exactly.
All right. I also want to ask about your podcast. What kind of things do you talk about?
So we largely talk about continuous delivery. But the continuous delivery itself is not a particularly large topic. So we end up talking about all the things that are around continuous delivery. So engineering, startups, lean startups and kind of, you know, that kind of movement, product management, you know, engineering management, and lots of different software things.
Very cool. And that ties in with Circle CI, I'm sure. I imagine our listeners are pretty familiar.
And also ties in with Dark very heavily.
Right.
Dark is a language that's basically built for continuous delivery.
Yeah. So I'm curious, when you say make backend programming 100 times easier, could you describe what the problem space is? Like what kind of applications, or what kind of, I'm sitting down to build X, will Dark make that 100 times easier?
So there's two primary things that we're targeting at the start. One is backends for single page web apps. So things that you might build in Reason or in React or Vue or Elm or all that sort of thing. And then the second is new microservices in existing microservice-based architectures. So really the way we think about it is that when you have a backend, all you really want to do is take data in some format and store it or send it somewhere else.
Okay.
But instead of doing that sort of simple thing, you end up building these incredibly complex architectures on top of Kubernetes, on top of Docker, and with long deployment pipelines. And you just spend your time doing things that aren't writing business logic.
Right.
And we basically designed something where as soon as you write code in the editor, it immediately goes into production.
Okay.
And there's like built-in continuous delivery things like database migrations and feature flags and that sort of thing to make that really safe. And as a result, you spend the overwhelming amount of your time writing actual business logic and very, very little time on things like infrastructure, monitoring, ops, security, et cetera, et cetera.
Cool. Okay, so when you describe that, I get the impression that it's tackling a similar problem to what Zeit's Now service is, or also maybe a little bit in the direction of Firebase. I mean, these kind of things mm-hmm. where it's like, we don't want you to hassle with servers and deployment. Let's make this as abstracted away as possible.
Yes, similar concepts. I would say like that and more.
Okay.
So we're also building our editor and our infrastructure are tied together, and they're also tied closely with the programming language, the Dart programming language. And the reason for that is we think that the way that computers, or the way that the software industry has developed, has been very, very iterative. So mm-hmm. You take Git. That basically does the same job as Subversion, which does the same job as CVS, which does the same job as RCS. And no one has really worked on how do we remove this step from how we write software. And by having a holistic editor infrastructure and language, we can remove a whole bunch of stuff that's being done. And so it's Firebase, good example. But like, imagine if Firebase just like really went with that concept way further.
Sure. Well, actually, so I'm also reminded of Glitch.com, that has mm-hmm. an editor. They've recently done a layer on top of Git to make that feel more reasonable.
Yep.
But of course, it's not the kind of thing that you'd use in production.
So yeah, we're one of the reasons that we talk about continuous delivery a lot in Dart is that it was specifically designed for like a thing that you use in production.
Yeah.
So a thing that's really safe to write things with almost zero deployment time.
Fantastic. Because I've had a lot of fun using Glitch for prototyping, getting things going.
I love it. I think it's great.
I guess Code Sandbox also plays in this space. There are a bunch of things where mm-hmm. it's like, we will make everything easy as long as you're just trying things out. But then when you want to go to production, there's this hurdle. Okay, how do I export out of here? Do I look at Kubernetes? Do I look at Now? Whatever it is.
Right. Yeah, and Dart is intended, is built from the ground up to be scalable and to do that hosting and that infrastructure for you, so that you don't get to the point where it's like, oh, now I need to, I've been experimenting with this toy, which I know is not a thing I believe, but is a thing people levy at Glitch and Firebase. So we're building it to avoid both that accusation and avoid it being true.
Fantastic. Well, I'll have to keep an eye on Dart and how that develops. But
thank you.
So in the course of building Dart, you previously were using Elm, and then you wrote Philippe 2. Did I pronounce that right?
It's Philippe the Second.
Oh, right. Philippe the Second. Tell us about that.
So Philippe the Second is a compiler that translates from Elm to OCaml. It's very confusing now. Is it translating to OCaml or to BuckleScript or to Reason? It's one of those.
Right.
And the reason that we built it is we had reached a bit of an end with where we felt we could get with our Elm front end. Dark is in the pre-product market fit stage. Mm-hmm. So we're doing lots and lots of experimentation and simple simple hacks to try out ideas and that kind of
totally.
Thing. And we kind of hit a bit of an end. So we decided to switch over to BuckleScript, and we had 10,000 lines of code.
All right.
And we also had a backend that was already written in OCaml.
Oh, okay.
So our first backend was written in Python, and that lasted for a couple of weeks before I got to the point that I couldn't manage it even by myself.
Sure.
So we had switched to OCaml about September 2007. So what's that? A year and a bit ago.
Okay.
But at the time, Reason I did not feel was mature enough to use.
For sure.
And so we kept with the Elm front end. But once we reached the end of it, we needed to do what I describe as a semi-automated port.
Okay.
It's not a compiler in the you know, it doesn't generate a binary at the other end. You can't keep writing in Elm. It's intended to aid your port over, and it largely does. It's largely a syntactic translation between two languages that are incredibly similar.
Okay, so you start with an Elm code base, you run Philippe II, and then some amount of work later, you have a working OCaml reason code base.
Yeah, so if you use BuckleScript T, which is a BuckleScript library for the Elm architecture,
right.
It's not exactly the same APIs, but it's very, very close. So what you can do that translation, and then I provide some files that you can add to your project to sort of keep a similar API to your old stuff, and then you'll be in reason. And then you have to make a decision about where to go next.
Okay, so how does the translation process work?
So I use Elm format to do the parsing of Elm.
Oh, cool.
And then I use the OCaml compiler. And if you've ever written a PPX, it's the same sort of idea as that. You're generating AST elements.
Right.
So Elm format is written in Haskell, and the other one is written in OCaml, obviously. So I had to add a bit of a layer to Elm format to dump out the JSON. It has a built-in JSON parser that is incomplete.
Oh, right.
And didn't have as much information as I wanted. So I went in there and added a deriving JSON to every type definition.
Oh, nice.
And then I tried the same thing on the other end, but their deriving formats were not the same. So the PPX deriving your JSON format in OCaml is not the same. So I wrote a little bit of a JSON parser, very similar API to BS JSON.
Uh-huh.
And then I got it in the right format, and then it was just a case of translating the types. And not everything matched directly, but most things had very little like analysis involved in changing it over.
I'm really impressed that it was at all doable. I mean, so Elm is very much based on Haskell, and I guess OCaml and Haskell are kind of cousins, but I would think that their type systems would be more different than that.
I would say, I mean, there's families of functional languages, and there's, you know, are you derived from an ML or are you derived from a Miranda? I think are the two families.
Sure.
But Elm always seemed to me to be an ML,
right?
And it doesn't have, you know, Haskell's complicated type system and monads and all that sort of thing. And it has things like pipelines that are native in OCaml and don't exist in Haskell. So like it was really a very one-to-one mapping.
Cool. And I guess Elm has put a lot of emphasis on, we are stripping things down, mm-hmm. kind of go with the simplest possible answer to a problem that people are seeing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I guess that
I think it would have been it is also a subset of OCaml. Like the doing the translation the other way, I think would have been would just not have worked. There's a lot more in OCaml, even though there's lots of things that we don't use, like the object system.
Sure.
I think it would have been challenging to go the other way.
Yeah. How ready is it for if someone else is like, huh, I would like to see, you know, I've got some Elm front end. Is it ready for people to use?
Yes, I think so. I would say you should budget about a week per 5,000 lines of code. So maybe a day per 1,000 lines to do the port. The major problems that we had were the minor differences between BuckleScript T and Elm. So we were doing things where we had an assumption that the various messages would arrive in a certain order, and then they arrived in a different order in BuckleScript T. But the, you know, getting it to the point where it compiled was actually a very straightforward thing. It was just then running through our unit and integration tests and figuring out I'm going to say that there was 10 Now that we have done this work, I would say that anyone who's doing it afterwards, that you're going to hit, you know, a bunch of little bugs like that, and they're obviously going to break your app, and you're going to have to figure it out.
And that's insidious, because it won't be caught by the type system. It's just different runtime behavior, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Huh. When you were doing this, did you consider trying to make BuckleScript T match the runtime behavior better?
So we definitely worked with the author of BuckleScript T. We made a couple of bug fixes. I think the actual challenge was that the Elm architecture, one part of it is this this functional reactive update model, very similar to what you have in React or mm-hmm. you know, Angular or any of these things that have gone into it. And there's this problem in all these of keys. You know, how do you know that this array has had a thing that is removed from it versus being a whole new array or something along those lines? And Elm really doesn't use keys. And looking at it now, it's kind of a miracle that it worked at all.
Okay.
But what we did with the direction BuckleScript T is going, and we kind of pushed it, and he's like, yeah, you're right, is to actually require keys rather than making it more Elm compatible, because the semantics are just kind of lucky.
Gotcha.
As to how the, you know, repaints or re-renders happen.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So that's Philippe II. You mentioned that you've been using OCaml for about a year, and you started using Reason more recently. How did you get interested in Reason and OCaml?
So I don't know if you know Sean Grove, who writes who does like Reason conferences and talks about Reason a mm-hmm. lot. He's the CEO of OneGraph. He's basically my oracle for where computers or for where software development is going.
Okay.
So I met him in 2012, 2013, something like that, and he helped us migrate our front end. So I was working at Circle CI. Everything was in Clojure.
Right.
And he got us into ClojureScript, and he helped us understand. He had an Elm architecture for ClojureScript, so he was talking, you know, about the Elm architecture in like 2014 or that sort of thing. So he started talking a lot about OCaml before, for like a year before I started Dark. So I had looked into this, and I had also tried to get more into static languages. So my early coding was in static languages in the 2000s, and then for the last while it's been a lot of dynamic languages, largely Clojure, but a lot of Python in there as mm-hmm. well. And I felt that it was just very difficult to write quickly changing code bases with any amount of certainty in dynamic languages. And in Clojure in particular, we just had the problem that there was nils everywhere.
Right.
And you could never tell where a nil was going to happen.
Yeah.
So I wanted to write this. If I was going to do a startup again, I was undecided about doing Dark at that point. I knew I wanted to do it in a static language. But when I did the prototype, I did a first like 2 week prototype to raise money. And I wrote that in Python. But once I started working on it again, I realized that it wasn't really amenable to you know, large rewrites of the kind that you do at the very start of a project. So I tried OCaml in knowing that, not really knowing that much about it, not having that much experience. We worked with some OCaml contractors to just come in and, you know, review our code and tell us what we were doing wrong, find libraries, fix bugs that we just weren't qualified to fix at the time.
Uh-huh.
And discovered that it was really, really good for the kind of large refactoring changes that we needed to make in the early search for product market fit.
Right.
Place. And we got a lot of the same benefits that we were already in Elm on the front end. We just basically saw the same benefits, and then we realized, oh, these are the same language.
Cool. When you mention being in Clojure and ClojureScript and mm-hmm. running into nils all over the place, I also did a bit of Clojure script several years ago, and that was one of the worst problems because you don't know where it's coming from. Because most of the functions, if they get a nil, they'll return a nil and be fine. And so eventually something breaks and you're like, there's no way to trace this back. And it's the same problem in JavaScript. You have an undefined, where did it come from? Who knows?
Right.
So I think the question that a lot of our listeners will have for you is, what caused you to shift from Elm to Reason? What Elm is an incredible language. I have a lot of respect for Evan and the stuff they're doing. And in fact, a lot of the work that I do on Reason is because I'm jealous of something that Elm has. But so what precipitated the shift?
It's funny. This is anywhere I posted about Philippe II. The first question was always, why did you leave Elm?
Right.
So I let me preface this as well by saying some of the same things that you just said. Elm is a lovely language. It's probably the nicest language I've ever used. The most like complete and elegant, and you know the documentation and the standard libraries and that sort of thing are amazing.
Yeah.
But I think it's fair to say that Elm has a philosophical difference from us in how we like to do things.
Okay.
So there was a recent change to Elm. There was a new release after about 18 months to Elm 19. And what it did was it removed native code. It also did a bunch of other great stuff. Better compiler, better support for single page apps. But it removed native code. And native code is the ability to call a function directly from JavaScript.
Okay.
So external in BuckleScript. And it removed that. Evan is the designer of the language and the main implementer, and he had some very good reasons for that. And one of the main things is that Elm likes to have no possibility of checked of exceptions happening at runtime.
Right.
And we abused that a little bit, and we certainly got some exceptions at runtime as a result of it. But we found that there was a bunch of areas where we just couldn't do what we were trying to do without that ability to do native code. And when I say it was a philosophical difference, what I mean by that is. You often get this in sort of static typing world, or this is one of the major differences between static and dynamic typing, is that in dynamic types you get to just do it. whatever little hacky thing you want to do right now, there's no compiler that you're fighting.
Right.
And it has it has a lot of downsides. It makes makes code harder to maintain and that sort of thing. But sometimes you need that. I consider native code to be the same sort of thing. It's like you don't really want it everywhere in your code base, but sometimes you need an escape hatch.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, when you're doing a startup and you're in this pre-product market fit stage, and you realize there is an elegant way to do this. It's a 1,000-line change. It'll take me a week and a half. Or there's this like little hacky thing, it'll take me 10 minutes. And it'll let me see if it works.
Right.
And it'll let me see if it works, and maybe I can put it behind a feature flag, and I can show it to the customer that was complaining about this thing, and see if that's actually the thing that they wanted. And that's really, really important for us. So that ability to take on a little bit of technical debt by adding new native code bindings and via these escape hatches, and then making the decision for yourself: do I want to keep this in? Do am I comfortable with this debt? Or in some cases, native code is actually the natural way to do it, and they're going through the hoops that Elm makes you jump through are actually a less natural way of doing things, at least according to how you think.
Sure.
So that was the main reason. We had a philosophical break, and once Elm 19 was in, it's very hard to stay in an old version of something. You don't get new bug fixes. You know, the community is moving on to this new thing. You know, it wouldn't have been possible for us to stay in Elm 18 as a long-term strategy. Totally. So we decided, you know, we were coming up to Christmas. It was the kind of time where you know, people get very little work done anyway in December. We decided that it was better to do the switchover then and build all the new stuff that we were trying to do in Reason rather than having new stuff that we needed to port over and making the port a much bigger job.
Right. Yeah, the point about taking on, being able to decide to take on some technical debt, I like that analogy where in a business context, often you will get a loan in order to, you know, and then mm-hmm. use that as leverage to grow your business. And you know right. that you will get a better return than you're paying.
And leverage is really the word there. Like, you know, an escape hatch in a programming language is the ability to leverage that escape hatch at a time where you really need to leverage that.
Right. And I guess one place where the analogy breaks down is there's no one necessarily calling you up once a month saying you need to pay down a little bit of this.
I'm not sure that's true.
Well, I guess depending on the size of your company and whether you have people that are keeping an eye on things, right?
I mean, I tend to find that every time I'm working on a little bit of the code base that has debt, you know, it's screaming out to me that it needs to be repaid.
Right. And that's a good
instinct. I may make the decision to, I think that personally, that's often the time I make the decision to pay down the debt. If continuing to hack on a particular area is going to be more expensive than just, you know, refactoring that thing and doing it right. Now, especially, you know, at that point, you're going to have a lot more data about how your code base went and what your customers need and how your product changed. And so it'll be a lot clearer what to actually do with that debt than perhaps it was when you took it on.
Yeah. And I guess, especially at the early stage, is when you want to be able to make those trade-offs mm-hmm. vigorously, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. When you're at the stage where your product just changes frequently, and obviously once your product stabilizes and you have a bunch of customers, you're making much smaller changes, you need less hacks, but then occasionally you need more hacks because you don't want to change your architecture all that much to solve small problems.
Right. Yeah. So now you've been using, like you said, OCaml for over a year, Reason for a month or so. What are your initial mm-hmm. likes and initial pain points that you've experienced?
So I guess to start with the good things, you know, OCaml is a wonderful language. It provides great guarantees that your code actually works. Reason is, or, you know, but we don't actually use Reason, we use BuckleScript.
Sure.
So we use the OCaml syntax of the Reason world. And it extends it. And in fact, I think it makes a lot more sense in the JavaScript world than it does in the backend world, because OCaml has really poor concurrency story.
Right.
So we've actually hit a bunch of dead ends on the back end that we aren't hitting in the front end.
Because the JavaScript runtime is already has that limit, and the
exactly yeah. So it's a relatively nice match, and then we're using web workers to do things in the background.
Oh, cool.
The things that I don't like about it. I think I hit this earlier. You know, is it OCaml? Is it Reason? Is it BuckleScript? And it's not just the naming, but it's the, you know, there seem to be separate ecosystems forming.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at tools like Essie, for example, or, you know, BuckleScript is working on Belt, which is the standard library, which just is not the same standard library as I'm using on the back end.
Sure.
And so I'm really not getting very much code reuse at all. The you would expect that we would have unified our types and removed a whole bunch of like, JSON middleware and that kind of thing. But actually that turned out to be relatively hard, and we do not currently use the same types on the front end and the back end.
Oh, that's a shame.
So there's we have a reasonified Elm code base at the moment. But I think that's challenging to undo, because at the front end we're using a belt.map.string, and on the back end we're using a core.string.map.
Right.
And they have different function names, and the very obvious thing here is that Reason uses camel case, and the OCaml uses snake case.
Right.
And so these are just those are different. And so you're not writing the same functions, and you're calling functions that are extremely similar but are not the same.
And so that context switching, I imagine, introduces a lot of friction, because it's like, wait, what's the order of arguments on this side versus this side?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that it's largely the inability to reuse code.
Uh-huh.
So we need to rewrite the same algorithm, and we were already doing that because Elm is was a different language, but it's kind of frustrating to have to do that now that we're using the same language on both ends. And in particular, one that's going in this direction in BuckleScript is the T first versus T last problem.
Right.
OCaml is, or at least Core, uses labeled arguments, and so it doesn't really have that problem. You can partially apply using any function or using any argument, and it doesn't. You're piping it in. The pipe puts it at the end, was fast pipe renamed? I feel that it's called something else now. In Reason,
it might be pipe last, or no, pipe first.
Pipe first, right? So there's like a pipe first thing. So now it's like, are you piping first? Are you piping last? It's a little bit of a mess. So actually something I started working on, but I never moved that far forward with it, but was writing a single standard library that sits on top of Belt and sits on top of Core.
Wow.
And allows us to have the same interface on the front end and the back end. But I'm a design document into that.
I'm
not much more.
I'm reminded of the XKCD comic. That is someone saying, "What? There are 13 different ways to do this thing that everyone needs to do. I'll make one that solves everyone's problems." And then someone else comes along and says, "There are 14 ways to do this thing."
Yeah. The other aphorism that I'll add to that is every problem in technology is either intermediation or disintermediation.
Okay, explain
that. You're either wrapping libraries, or you're saying this thing is all things to all people, and I need a specialized version.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty appropriate. And yeah, in the OCaml world, there are like 4 or 5 standard libraries that kind of have a lot of traction. Which is,
are there? It seems like batteries is dead.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. I just don't see much movement, and I was looking at it recently because there's has some Unicode stuff in there that we wanted to do on the back end, and it's stuck at Unicode 3, and it just doesn't seem to be moving forward.
Okay,
it took months for them to get OCaml came out with a new version like 4.7 or something. It was months behind. So we used one library from batteries, and we ended up just copying and pasting that function into our code base.
Okay.
But core is amazing. Like the core kernel base, whatever Jane Street is doing, it's a wonderful, complete library. We're extremely happy with that. And I don't see much alternative on the back end.
Right. Yeah. If you're doing back end server work, core is where it's at. It would be wonderful. I mean, as I understand it, some of the impetus for writing Belt, on the one hand, mm-hmm. Core is not, I mean, it's not BuckleScript compatible. It's written in the, mm-hmm. you know, for OCaml native. And I also imagine that it wasn't necessarily written with, you know, bundle size in mind as much mm-hmm. as you need to be thinking about that in JavaScript, mm-hmm. and kind of the runtime characteristics that JavaScript brings to the table.
I mean, the differences between the constraints are real, and it makes sense to me that there are those two separate libraries that have separate purposes. What I would hope for is a common interface to them.
I definitely dream of a world where native OCaml development and front end BuckleScript development are almost identical.
We have spent way too much time on technical debt, so it's not in my near future. Mm-hmm. But if the problem is still there in a couple of months, I might pick it up again.
All right. So if anyone listening wants to take that on, do Paul a favor.
Yeah, I'd send you my design docs. Talk through what needs to happen, in my opinion.
Yeah. So that was kind of pain points and likes for OCaml. What do you still miss from Elm?
So I guess the most obvious thing is just how nice a language Elm is.
Yeah.
OCaml is not. I mean, just like even syntactically, like it took much longer to learn than it should have. And actually, the fact that we were writing Elm at the same time made it easier, because at least we could compare the you know, this janky syntax to this lovely syntax that does the same thing. Similarly, Elm has a beautiful and very complete standard library.
Right.
In particular, it has a bunch of extra libraries. So there's the string extra and JSON extra and result extra and option extra and that list extra, all that sort of thing. That fill out the kind of thing that don't necessarily fit into the core library, or that are a little bit more niche.
Okay.
So there's that, but there's also in terms of the syntax, there's a couple of really beautiful things that OCaml could just like steal.
Okay.
So the fact when you're piping into something and you want to use you want to like access a field, you can write dot field name, and it will consider that as a first class function.
Right.
And you can use constructor names in the same way. If you just use a constructor name, it will be a constructor with, you know, three parameters or however number of parameters there are in the constructors. And OCaml just doesn't have that.
Right.
And it's just, you know, it's the sort of thing that you could add in without changing the language at all, and it would just be much more ergonomic.
Right. Well, and actually speaking of pipe first, pipe first does do the constructor as function thing.
Oh, interesting.
Which you can't do with pipe in OCaml, because pipe is not a language level construct. It is a, you know, it's a function defined like any other function you could define.
Yeah. So there's a PPX that does that in the core ecosystem called PPX, pipe bang.
Okay.
The thing is, it only works in pipes, and it works by like by flattening out the pipes, but it doesn't work in other places where you might want to use it as a first class function. So passing it to a map or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, so when I sometime last year, I made a Lisp syntax for OCaml,
mm-hmm.
And that was one of the things that I did. I was borrowing from closure syntax. So if you do hashtag mm-hmm. and then a field name, that can be used as a function that you can pass anywhere, like a first class function.
Yeah, that's great. And closure has a lot of those ergonomic things,
right?
It has pipes, and of course in pipes you can, it has really easy lambdas, mm-hmm. To like syntactic shortcuts for nice lambdas and that kind of thing. And I guess one of the things that I lament from both OCaml and Elm is the lack of a macro system.
Right.
And you see people writing PPXs the intellectual equivalent of a macro is a PPX, but they're, you know, much, much harder to write and much more complex, and getting them into your build system is more complicated and all that versus you know, simple macros in Clojure.
Totally. Yeah, I keep looking at Rust's macro system, because mm-hmm. They've done so much work and lots of iteration trying to make it make sense and be easy to use and relatively difficult to shoot yourself in the foot. And I keep thinking one of these days I'll get around to bringing that into Reason.
Yeah. Well, we are taking a lot of direction from Rust in the design of Dark. Mm-hmm. For the most part, Rust does everything right. So we're doing Unicode support at the moment, and so we're going and looking what does Rust do, and what conversations are Rust people having about how Unicode works in Rust. Mm-hmm. And they did a really good job with the language, with the community, with the documentation, with the, you know, tutorials. They just did like a really good job in general.
Yeah, I have a lot of admiration for them. I'd love to have somebody. If someone's listening who uses Rust a lot and also uses Reason, I'd love to interview you about it. So there's
one more thing that I miss from Elm, and I feel this on the back end as well as the front end. So it's just knowing what exceptions can happen.
Hmm.
So Elm makes it easy to know that there are no exceptions, unless you use native. So they can still happen, but in OCaml, I just want to know at any particular call site, like, what could go wrong here?
Right.
And there isn't a tool to do that. It isn't built into Merlin. And given it might be more difficult given the JavaScript world and exceptions can kind of come from anywhere. But for code that's in pure, you know, Reason or OCaml, there should be a tool that just says, you know, here you can have a not found exception and this other exception and this other exception, and they're thrown in these libraries.
Right. Yeah, I've talked to Sean Grove about that, actually. Mm-hmm. And the Reason language server that I wrote for VS Code and other editor applications has a lot of the information that you would need to build a tool like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, if you want to do it, I guess, perfectly well, you have to solve mm-hmm. a lot of the same problems that, actually the typed effects work is solving.
Mm-hmm.
Because for example, marking a function as these are the kinds of exceptions it can raise. Well, list.map mm-hmm. can raise any of the exceptions that the function passed into it can raise.
Of course, yeah.
And, you know, automatically determining that, is a very interesting mm-hmm. problem, but I do think that it's doable.
I think that would be a very valuable thing, and that's one of the things that we're building in Dark.
Cool.
One of the nice experiences when you control your own language.
Right. So when are we going to get a teaser of what Dark looks like?
So we at the moment are in very closed alpha. we have a handful of customers who are using it and who are building actual websites with uh-huh. it. And we are in the process of fleshing out the language, you know, supporting libraries, you know, doing things like Unicode support. So lots of work to do. I think you'll be looking for it in 2020.
Okay, cool. Well, I think that gets through all the questions I have. Any parting thoughts?
I guess the fundamental feeling I have around this whole thing, around, you know, the Elm versus Reason and that kind of thing, is escape hatches.
Uh-huh.
I think language designers need to spend a lot of time thinking about what escape hatches they provide to their communities and to their users. I know this was something I spent a lot of time thinking about building CircleCI. It's something we think about building Dark, and I think it's one of the fundamental things that makes languages really usable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, evidently with Elm, there are a lot of people who really appreciate not having to worry about escape hatches. There's a class of problems that totally fit within that, but.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
With what you were doing with Dark, and there are there are definitely places where I appreciate that Reason has some escape hatches to go to.
Yeah, and often, you know, the places that I use the escape hatches, they you know, it can be easy to architect things badly as a result, or to, you know, put too much code on the wrong side of the interface or something like
totally.
That. But when you don't have it, that's when you really feel it.
Sure. Well, that sounds like a good note to end on. Thank you so much for coming on the show, telling us about Dark and your experience going from Elm to Reason.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.